Glad you guys are here today. It's just always fun to come and celebrate communion together. And this morning we get a chance to continue as we talk about the far country and this journey into the unknown that we've been talking about over the last several weeks. And you may or may not know that, you know, in Africa, one of the ways that they trap monkeys, there's a variety of ways they do this, but one of the ways they do that is to take a gourd or a coconut and hollow it out, have a little hole in the side, attach a chain or a rope or something to it, and attach it to a tree or a stump of some sort, and then put some goodie on the inside of the gourd so that when the monkeys come, they see the goodie, they smell the goodie, they come and get it, they stick their hand inside the hole, grab a hold of whatever's in there, and the hole is big enough to get their hand in, but not big enough to get their fist back out. And so they can reach in and grab the goodie, but then now that they have their hand in the on the goodie, you know, they just freak out, they scream, bloody murder, and in order to get away, all they have to do is let go of the goodie and take their hand back out. But they won't do it, because once we get our hands on the goodie, we have a hard time letting go of the goodie to move forward, and so the trappers just simply come up and trap them. So I realized that my good friend Tim keeps this monkey trap in his office all the time. And I didn't, because I went in the other day and I stuck my hand in to get a goodie, and I could not get my hand back out of, and so now I'm in a real bind, because I have to make a choice. Hang on to the goodie, in which case I'll never actually get the goodie, or I have to kind of open my hand up and take it back out. I have to let go of the goodie to keep the goodie, which is so counterintuitive. And the dilemma for you and I is, the more important the goodie is, the tighter you cling to the goodie, right? The more important the treasure is, the more, here, let me get rid of that one. Just grab that. So there you go, Dottie. We can throw some more around later, but you get the principle, right? Is that the more you treasure something, the more you cling to the something. Because by nature, you and I are grabbers, we are graspers, we are clingers, right? A.W. Tozer says it this way. He says, there is within the human heart a tough, fibrous root of fallen life whose nature is to possess, always to possess. It covets things with a deep and fierce passion. The pronouns my and mine look innocent enough in print, but their constant and universal usage points to the darkness of our heart. See, the more we value something, the harder it is to let go of. The more we value something, the more likely it is going to get in competition with God, that we worship it and see that as a solution to our lives. And so we cling to it. We hang on to it with all that we have. You know, it's interesting. Over the last several weeks, we've been talking about this far country, this journey into the unknown, right? That God calls us to leave here and to go there, to leave our comfort zones, our people, our country, to go to this place, and he's going to lead us over there. In the process, we've talked about how the promise to Abraham is Isaac. That there's this great promise that he's going to have a son, that son's going to become a great nation, and through that, it's going to bless the whole world. And Abraham keeps waiting, and he keeps waiting, and he keeps waiting. And 2.5 decades go by until it's just over the hill, and it's too late, and there's no way that he and Sarah are going to ever have any kids, and yet God shows up, and there's Isaac. And it's in that moment, I really think that after Isaac shows up, that Abraham has this kind of like, whew, glad that's over with moment. Matter of fact, when you come to chapter 21, one of the things you pick up is at the end of the chapter, Abraham signs a peace treaty with the nations around him. And what's happened is, and he begins to plant a tree. And so Abraham is settling in. The nomadic life is over. He's no longer wandering. He's no longer, you know, he's beginning to settle in and put down some roots. And you can almost envision Abraham on the front porch, in the swing, on the little bar, kind of kicking back, putting his feet up on the table. He's got a little umbrella drink, and he's sitting back, and he's going, I've got a place, I've got a son, life is good. Finally, I'm at rest. I'm at peace. The wandering is over. The waiting is over. Life is now working. Finally. But it's in that moment that I think Abraham is forced to face his greatest fear. The waiting was hard. I wonder if our greatest challenges aren't actually after the journey is over. I think that's the case. Mary, grab your Bible, turn over if you would to Genesis 22. Let me work this thought with you for a little bit this morning. And again, Abraham, he's over 100 years old. He's been in this journey with the Lord for 35, 45 years. He's finally got his feet up on the table, and things are kind of going well. So let me just read this to you, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about it. Starting in verse 1, it says, sometime later, we don't really know when, but later, after Isaac shows up, God tested Abraham, and he said to him, Abraham. Abraham said, here I am. Then God said, take your son, your only son, the son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain that I will show you. Very similar to what happened in Genesis 12, isn't it? Go to a place I'm going to show you. Except this time he says, take Isaac and sacrifice him. So early the next morning, Abraham got up, loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. And when he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, you stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. And Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Father Abraham, Father? Abraham replied, yes, my son. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Keen grasp of the situation. Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out from heaven, Abraham, Abraham, he says, here I am. Do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by his horns. He went over and he took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make you descendants, your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sands on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. And then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba. All right, what you and I know, looking at this, that Abraham doesn't know, is verse 1. In verse 1, God, the writer tells us, this is a test. Abraham doesn't know this is a test. See, this is a test. It is only a test that is going on here. And the writer tells us right up front that that is what is going on, and God is going to test Abraham at his most vulnerable, difficult place. Because God is keenly aware of what he is about to ask Abraham. In verse 2, the way he pounds on this thing, it's kind of like over and over again, he says, Abraham, I need you to take your son. Now, let's be clear. It's really your only real son. I know there's Ishmael, but you've now kind of abandoned him. It's the son you've been waiting for. It is the son that you love, the son that you adore. And in case there's any confusion, his name is Isaac. And God kind of nails down here. He says, I need you to take this treasure that you have received, and I'm going to ask you to sacrifice it. As I've spent time reflecting on Abraham this week, I've come up with a couple of startling, unsettling observations. And the first is this, is that the tests get harder over time. The tests just keep getting harder over time. If you're like Abraham, if you're like me, when you've come through some really tough test, like you've been wandering in the wilderness for 25 years, you've been waiting for the sun, and the sun shows up, you kind of go, woo, baby, I'm glad that's over with. Now we can slip into normal or peace or whatever it is. Isn't it interesting? It never says up until this point that God tested Abraham. The test actually came after the journey. It became after the promise was fulfilled. It came after everything he's been waiting for has now shown up and taken place. And so I think what I begin to see in this thing is that God, true faith is forged over a lifetime, right? Real faith is forged over a lifetime. And God brings the level of test you can handle at any given moment in your life as he stretches and grows your faith. Right? I can't prove this. I really can't prove this. But I am relatively convinced that Abraham would have failed this test earlier in life. This level of test is reserved for a scarred, battle-weary individual who has had their faith tested over and over again. In order to face a test of this magnitude requires a significant level of growth and faith on our own part. And it makes all the sense in the world when you think about it, because when the test that we give to a second grader is completely different from the test we give to a high schooler or a college student or a grad student, right? You would never give a second grader the ACT or the SAT. You're not going to give them the GRE or the MCAT. But the more you mature, but you know what, that second grader, when they get the test, they're going, this is the hardest thing ever. And the tests just get harder and harder and harder over time. I found that, frankly, men and women, I found that a little unsettling. When I looked back over my life, when I looked back over the various tests I've been through, the hard things I've faced all along the way, and to kind of go, oh, wait a minute. Could it be that the really hard tests are still ahead? That these are all the building blocks of faith to prepare me? And I just started thinking over all kinds of events in my life that I've gone. I thought about my first son when he was born, and we race him from one hospital to another hospital where he ends up in ICU, and the doc says, hey, he's got a 50-50 chance overnight. We'll see. I thought of flying up to Nashville to pick up a first-year college student who'd been a part of my ministry forever because his entire family went down in a plane crash. And I had to go and get him and bring him home. I thought of some of the things we as a church have faced through the years, the struggles, the hardships, you know, having a key staff people have affairs and all of this stuff, thinking, what if that's not the hardest test yet? See, I think God is in the process of forging our faith bit by bit by bit. He will never give you more than you can handle. He won't test you with more than you can take in the moment. And yet the tests are there to stretch us. So that was the first thing. The tests get harder over time. The second thing I began to realize is that the hardest tests that we face in life are those that threaten our Isaacs. And we've all got Isaacs. We've all got this thing we've been clinging to, these treasures. And the greatest test, the hardest test, the greatest test you will face are the very ones that threaten what you treasure most, whatever that may be. And that's why God comes to Abraham and says, hey, by the way, your treasure, this son, really the only son, the only thing you really treasure, this son, the one that you really and truly love with all of your heart, let me name it, it's Isaac. God says, says, I need you to sacrifice this. This is the son he'd waited for forever. And so the really hard tests are when God challenges those things that we love so dearly that compete with our allegiance with him. They are the things that begin to be idols in our lives. And we've all got Isaacs. You can break them up into a handful of categories, right? For some of us, our Isaacs are things. There are these possessions that we've gotten our hands on. There's the perfect house, the perfect car. It may be something big like a house. It may be something small like a ring. It may be some you know, the prized bass boat or whatever it may be. We have these possessions that when God begins to threaten them, the car is in a wreck. The house has a leak. Whatever it may be, it all of a sudden challenges the very core of our being. You know, it could be, for some of you, it may be your job, it's your vocation. You know, one of the realities of life is that the longer you work, the more identified with your work you become. All those part-time jobs I had when I was in high school and college, I didn't care. If I got fired, I didn't care. But you know what? Eventually you get a position. And so when I come up to say to you, tell me about yourself, what do you tell me? Oh, I'm a teacher. I'm a banker, right? I'm a dentist. I'm a stay-at-home mom. Well, that's not exactly who you are. It's what you do. But our identity gets tied up in our work. And we have a hard time separating that. So when our work gets threatened, our identity gets threatened. And it can become an Isaac. Some of it's relationships, right? It's these people that are moved into our lives. You know, God gives you a spouse, or he gives you kids. And all of a sudden, you know, or maybe it's a friend. And when those things get threatened, when the friendship goes on the rocks and gets sideways, you get kind of get crazy in your head. When the kids move out and leave you at home, you have the empty nest. Sometimes you get lost. You don't know who you are anymore. Or when your kids are going through struggle, because isn't it the truth, certainly with moms, I see it with dads, we're only as happy as our happiest kid, right? And we are as sad as our saddest kid, because we're tied to that. They are our Isaacs. Yeah, I remember I was working out in Odessa back in college. I went out there to get rich one summer, you know. Five of us actually moved into a bedroom and a half trailer. You know, it was tiny thing, and we were out there working, and one of the guys I was staying with was a guy named Kip Kindred. I'd never met him till that summer. I met him through a gal I knew from Arlington, and so we all kind of ended up in this place together, and Kip and Julie had been dating for a while, and one day, Kip got a letter. It wasn't a Dear John. It started off, Dear Isaac. It's not like she was confused and sent the letter to the wrong guy. What she was saying is, you have become this treasure to me, and you've almost become more important to me than God, and that's unhealthy. You know, God allows our Isaacs to be threatened, and it really is to surface one thing. What God wanted from Abraham and who wants from us today is trust. All of this stuff, even with Isaac, with Abraham, the real question that God is asking is, do you trust me? Do you trust me that I'm good? Do you trust me that I care? Do you trust me that I love you? Do you trust me that I'm faithful? Do you trust me that I will take care of you and I know where it's going? See, when your Isaacs get threatened, all God is trying to discover is, do you trust him to know what he's doing with your Isaac? Ben Patterson says on your outline, he says that it has been said that faith is not believing something regardless of the evidence, but doing something regardless of the consequences. Men and women, that's powerful. Because if we're not careful, we think faith is all up in our head and how we think. But real faith, real trust, is when I do something in spite of the consequences and having to let go of it. That's really what's going on here. Because what God keeps asking is, will you trust me? with your life, with your Isaac, with your treasure? Will you trust me? And it kind of gets fleshed out in about four different ways. There's really four different questions that God is asking here. And one of them is this. He says, will you trust me enough to be available to me? Right? Will you trust me to be available when I call? It's because God makes the call. He says, Abraham. And what Abraham says, he says, here I am. He says it over and over. Really, he says the same thing to Isaac. God says, Abraham, he goes, here I am. And Isaac says, hey, Father, he goes, here I am. And then God says again, hey, Abraham, here I am. And really, what he's saying is, I'm here to serve. Whatever you want. It's the response of a servant. It's saying, as you wish, what can I do? Where do I go from here? What do you want? Right? And it's one little Hebrew word. I know this because my friend in college, but it was named, it's Hineni. And my friend Neil, one day, he had this leather-covered Bible. He'd ripped the cover off his Bible, put a leather thing on here, and had stamped here on the binding, Hineni, which I walked up and said, your name is not Hineni. Why? He said, because whenever I pick up my Bible, I want to have my immediate response to say, God, here I am. What do you want? So that when God speaks through his word, when God speaks through anything, I'm ready to obey. And so really what God is saying to Abraham is, do you trust me enough to be available whenever I call? Second thing he's saying is, do you trust me enough that you will obey me quickly and completely? Whatever it is, are you going to hold back? And what you see in the story is great because God speaks. And then what does it say there? It says the first thing in the morning, Abraham got up and left. The very next day, he gets up, he grabs the gear, and off he goes. Early in the morning, he takes off. And so there's no pause. There's no like, well, let me think about it. Let me pray about it. Let me get a committee together. Let me get my small group, and we'll all have a fasting moment and figure it out. No, it's like God said, and he goes. Now, I do tend to think that Abraham left early in the morning so he could get out of Dodge before Sarah got up, right? I mean, no husband wants to try to explain this to his wife. I mean, I'm telling you right now, that is not going to work very well. So there's this immediate sense of whatever you say, God, I'll do it right now. Third question is, will you trust me enough to keep my promises? I mean, Abraham's got all these promises that God has made. He's going to bless the entire world through Isaac. That Isaac is going to become this great nation. And so Abraham is kind of on the horns of a dilemma here. God, you have said that you're going to do all of this through Isaac, and yet now you are asking me to sacrifice Isaac. You may come to, you know, you can say, God, you said you have a good plan for my life, but my life looks like it's going off the rails. God, you've said that you're going to provide for us, but the expenses are going crazy and there's not enough income, or our job is being threatened. And so there's this question of what he's really saying is, will you trust my promises? Isn't it interesting that as we read through the story, what Abraham says to the servants, he says, hey, you guys stay here. Isaac and I are going to go up on the mountain and worship. And he doesn't say, and I'll be back by myself. Hint, hint. What he says is, we're going up and we're coming back. Isaac's walking along and he's a smart kid. Hey, you've got some fire. We've got some wood. We're going to need a sacrifice. Hey, God. Or, hey, Dad, where's the lamb? You know, and as we've joked before, Abraham doesn't turn around and go, well, can you say bah? Right? You're looking a little woolly. You know, he doesn't, you know. You see what he says? God will provide. I don't really know how. Hebrews kind of hints this. It hints that Abraham saw and believed that God would raise him from the dead. It almost appears that as they're walking along, because remember, there's not a lot of processing time. Abraham had probably not been sitting in the Barca lounge going, no, if God ever called me to sacrifice Isaac, I better raise him from the dead. No, what he gets is, get up, go, and off he goes. So in 3 days he's walking, he's thinking. He's got to be grappling through, what on earth is God going to do? And in my own thinking, what I think he's going on in his head is Sarah's womb was dead, and God resurrected it for Isaac. If Isaac dies, somehow God will resurrect. And he held on to that promise. And so really, what he's going to do is come to you and say, do you trust my promises? And so Abraham moves forward, really trusting that God is going to provide all along the way. Because see, our greatest faith challenge is always going to be, is there something I can lose that would cause me to lose my faith in God? Is there something I could lose? Can I trust his promises in spite of? And look, there are some folks in this body right now as we sit here who have lost incredible things and would tell you that even though it's hard, God is still good and God is still faithful. Finally, he asked the question, do you trust me enough to do what I say? Just to do what I say, will you do it? And it's at the end of that that God twice comes along and says, after all this has gone and gone, in verses 12 and 15 or 16, he says, now I know that you fear me. Not afraid. Now I know that you trust me. Now I know that wholeheartedly you're committed to me. Now I know. Because Abraham, guys, he doesn't know what's going to happen, doesn't know when it's going to happen, doesn't know how it's going to happen. But he says, okay, I'll go. See, all of the tests are really the question of will you trust me? Will you trust me? I'm really kind of increasingly convinced that this journey into the unknown that we're in the middle of, this wandering by faith, once we arrive, that the greatest test is actually on the other side of it. Because now we finally have received. The kid has finally turned around. The marriage is finally saved. The loved one is finally off drugs. The job is finally secure. And when we think, finally, that real often the real test is after that. Now we got a couple of minutes left, and let me shift gears for you. In the final moments, I really want to talk about the difference between my Isaac and God's Isaac. This story of Isaac is just the greatest parallel of the character and the life of Christ of almost any other story in the Scriptures. When you look at Isaac and you look at Jesus, you look at this thing and they overlap, there are so many similarities. Even just the way God addresses and talks about Isaac over and over again, your one and only son whom you love. Man, that's John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. It's how God keeps speaking to Jesus, that my beloved son. When Abraham makes his way to Moriah, if you're new to Bible study, that may not sound like just some vague place. Moriah is Jerusalem. We know that from Chronicles, that Moriah is a part of Jerusalem. It's a hill right by the hill that Jesus was sacrificed on, that Abraham took Isaac to the exact same place that Jesus went to die on the cross. And it's this place. When it takes off and it's Abraham with these two servants, it's so reminiscent of Jesus going to the cross with the two thieves that they go for 3 days, similar to where Jesus is in the tomb. It's that Isaac carries the wood on his back in the exact same way that Jesus carries the cross. That Isaac submits to the Father. It's not written that way, but there's never any hint that somehow that Abraham is having to fight with Isaac to get him onto the altar. Let me just assure you, there's not a 110-year-old person in the world that's going to take a 10-year-old, right? I don't care if they've been doing Pilates. It's Isaac willingly, because he trusts his father, lays on the altar. Men and women, Jesus wasn't forced to the cross. He chose the cross. They didn't have to wrestle him down to nail him. He spread out to allow himself to be nailed. And then the script passage says, on the mountain of the Lord it'll be provided. On the hill of Calvary, where Jesus died, God provided. But there's one huge, crucial difference in the story. It's that when Abraham grabs the knife to plunge it into Isaac's heart, the father stops him. And he provides the ram. And when Jesus is hanging on the cross, the spear is ready to be plunged into the heart of Christ. Our Heavenly Father does not stop the dagger. Our Father allows His Son, His only Son, to die. So that where God can look at Abraham and say, now I know that you trust me. We can look at the cross and say, now I know how much you love me. Because you gave your only Son for me. Jesus hints. He hints that the armies of heaven were saddled up, loaded up, and ready to ride to his rescue. He hints and says that all he has to say is come, and the armies of heaven would have ridden to his rescue and deliver him from the cross. And yet the Father never stops the sacrifice. As it says in Romans, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with Christ, graciously give us all things? And men and women, we stick our hand in the monkey trap, and we cling to the stuff, and saying, God, I got to have this to make it, because I'm afraid you won't give me anymore. And when God says, I've given you my very best. I'll hold nothing back. Do you trust me? Do you trust me? Can you open your hands and release that which I've given you and trust me with it? Or will you cling to it? Do you trust me? Let's pray.